Okay, I so first of all, I want to just thank the organizers, because I think this is a very wonderful, stimulating atmosphere where we can exchange these ideas, you know, both in seminars and informally. And Gary gave us this very nice introduction the first day, outlining the main problems. And what I wanted to tell you about today is what has been happening in loop quantum gravity. And in fact, there has been rather significant progress on all the four problems that Gary discussed on the first day, or the four topics that he outlined for us the first day. And so I had a little bit of a problem. I mean, the idea was that I should give an overview. And so first I thought I would summarize what has happened. And then when I started preparing it, I realized that there's going to be a laundry list of things that have happened. And then people wouldn't really get a good understanding of why something non-trivial happens and so on. So I changed the strategy, and what I'm going to do is more than half the talk, or about half the talk, I'm going to talk about one specific calculation, right? One specific model. And what is happening in other cases is analogous. Of course, there are differences. I'm choosing a case which is not absolutely the simplest one, but close to the absolutely simplest one. And so I'll have some introductory remarks, and at the end, I will also tell you about at least a brief idea about what else is happening. So the particular model that I'm going to consider is really contained in this paper, which is just about to appear in PhysRev. And it's also kind of a newer model, because some of you at least have heard me speak about some models before, so I thought I would talk about a new model so you won't be totally bored, these people. And it's some of the mathematical input for this model comes from this paper, which also appeared on GRQC in December. There are several things that have happened, but if you want to get kind of a bird's eye view of what is happening in about, you know, I don't know, 15, 20 pages, then there is a conference review here. And for developments that happened before 2005, Martin has written a very detailed Living Reviews article on quantum cosmology. So let me begin. And again, in the very first day, we discussed all these topics, so I'll just be a little bit quick in the first couple of transparencies. Namely, in general relativity, sort of a lot of its elegance, beauty, and power comes from the fact that the gravitational field is coded in the very geometry of space-time. But this means that unlike in other fields, like classical Maxwell fields, for example, classical Maxwell fields could go singular, but Minkowski space is perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with Minkowski space. But in general relativity, space-time itself ends at the singularities. And then there is a general expectation that this, of course, is happening because we are pushing the theory beyond the domain of its applicability, and we must incorporate quantum physics. So in loop quantum gravity, what happens is basically that the singularities, the physics does not stop at the singularities. And there's a quantum geometry underlying loop quantum gravity. Because of that, this life of physics, so to say, is extended beyond singularities. And there has been resolution of space-like singularities in various models. And if you look at the literature, it has been done in kind of three levels. The first level is that, this is supposed to be just introductory remarks, so don't expect that you understand every word of it, but I hope to go in more detail about these as I go along. So the first level is that in this program, the quantum dynamics is really governed by the so-called Hamiltonian constraint operator. And that constraint operator, so to say, does not break down at the singularities. So the quantum Hamiltonian constraint does not break down. And this was first pointed out in this very pioneering work by Martin Boyewald about 5 years ago in the context of simplest models in cosmology. And since then, at this level, the fact that the constraint does not break down has been extended to many, many models, both cosmological models with anisotropies, for example, black hole interior models, and Martin has also extended them to some midi-superspaces. But then there is a more sophisticated level, so not only is the first part shown, but in fact what one can do is construct the physical Hilbert space. So the point up here is, as again, I'll explain this in more detail. The point up here is that to begin with, you begin with a kinematical Hilbert space on which you can write down this quantum constraint. And then you want to solve this quantum constraint. And the solutions are almost never, even for simple mechanical systems, in the kinematic and Hilbert space. So we need to extend, we need to give in a product on the space of solutions to the constraint and construct a physical Hilbert space, and then construct observables, which are called technically Dirac observables, which are well defined on this physical Hilbert space. And then, in say, at least it would be nice if in simple models one actually has an emergent time. And if this happens, then one has a physical Hilbert space, Dirac observables, emergent time, and so one can unambiguously talk about what is happening physically. And this second step, this more sophisticated step, has been carried out in a whole bunch of homogeneous models. And finally, the third step, which is to say, not only the Hamiltonian constraint is well defined, not only do we have the physical Hilbert space, but in fact, you have detailed numerical solutions. You also can then see what happens under by numerical solutions, what happens to various physical states. And then to understand the physics of these numerical simulations, you also can have effective equations, and one can compare the solutions of the effective equations with the numerical simulations and what happens and so on. And this last step has been only carried out so far in the homogeneous isotropic model, just because even though numerics is not as complicated as in the binary black hole problem, etc., but it's still sophisticated. And in fact, even the cases that have been looked at, one had to tackle some very interesting and non-trivial numerical problems.
Okay.
So the statement is, I think this will become clear in what sense it is regulated, maybe. So it's a quantum mechanical system, so there is certainly factor ordering, and there is a certain prescription that is given in order to do this factor ordering. But what has also been done is actually both, all three, in the simplest models, we also change factor ordering and see if in fact the results change, and the results do not change. So this is what is happening in LQ, in loop quantum gravity. And the goal of this talk, as I said, was to provide a bird's eye view, but focus on this third thing, that is to say the most detailed models, and then comment on the other things that have happened on one and two. So in a way, the singularities I'm considering are much more physically interesting than, for example, the null singularities that Steve Shanker talked to us about yesterday. Because this really is kind of the Big Bang, the Big Crunch singularities. On the other hand, my task is much simpler, because I'm not going to start with a candidate full theory of quantum gravity and then systematically derive from this full theory of quantum gravity various results. What we're going to do is what is called the mini superspace approximation. That is to say, we are going to first symmetrically reduce the theory and then just go over to quantum theory from that. And the organization then is that first I would like to spend a few minutes talking about the conceptual setting, continue about that, this topic. Then I'll tell you about loop quantum cosmology, and then the detailed model that I mentioned. So again, some of the long-standing questions that are expected to be answered from quantum theory of gravity. And again, these are the questions that we actually discussed in the first, that Gary wrote down, the first topic. But I'm just restricting myself roughly to the first three topics, that is to say, not the black hole singularities, but to the cosmological singularities. So the first question is the following. So we expect general relativity to fail, as again David has pointed out to us, when the curvature becomes roughly Planck scale, and then something else should take over. But the question is really, is there a systematic way to say until what stage we can trust general relativity? How close to the Big Bang does a smooth space-time of general relativity make sense? In particular, it's of course assumed that during the inflationary era, space-time can be taken to be classical. Now, is this something we can justify, at least in these simple scenarios, a priori? In other words, can you actually solve the quantum equations and show from the quantum equations that classical equations hold very well when, for example, at the onset of inflation? That is to say, when the density of matter field is about is 1 upon few times the Planck density. The next question is the Big Bang singularity naturally resolved by quantum gravity? And I will explain in detail, but the short answer has been that if you looked at the Wheeler DeWitt theory, the theory that has been around for a while, which was written down also on the first day, in which the wave functions are functions of the metric, and you write down the quantum equations and see what happens, the answer there is no, and I'm going to explain in what sense this answer is no. The next question is there a new principle or a boundary condition at the Big Bang that is essential? For example, the Hartle-Hawking boundary proposal, no boundary proposal. I mean, is this something that has to be supplemented? Does quantum theory by itself is the quantum theory by itself incomplete? Quantum general relativity, do we have to add something else to it? Or is it the case that the equations of quantum general relativity themselves tell us that in fact everything is well defined, we don't need any specific boundary condition? The next question is the quantum evolution across the singularity deterministic? And as again, the very first day, we saw that in things like pre-Big Bang and ekpyrotic scenarios, there's a pre-Big Bang branch, there's a post-Big Bang branch, but they are not joined together by deterministic evolution. The hope always has been that non-perturbability effects will actually enable us to join them, but so far, this hope has not been realized. And finally, what is on the other side? Is there a quantum form, or is there another classical universe? This, in some sense, is a question about, is there a bounce, or does the space-time just doesn't make any sense? Classical general relativity or continuum, does it just completely break down? So these are the questions which have been with us for quite some time. And there are a couple of other questions which are sort of more specific to models, to approaches which are based from general relativity or supergravity. Namely, in these cases, in the cosmological context, the dynamics is really governed by the Hamiltonian constraint, and so the question is really, how does one extract physics from the solution of the Hamiltonian constraint? For example, you have the solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, but then what do I do with the solution? How do I interpret it? Is there inner product? Is there a physical Hilbert space? Are there observables, etc.? And technically, in the olden days, it was said that, well, if you just solve the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you have frozen formalism. All you have is the solution to this equation. There's no explicit time there anywhere. So is there, in fact, an emergent time so that we can reinterpret the solution to the equation as really evolving with respect to this emergent time? And in this Misner parametrization that Beverly told us about, scale factor is a natural candidate. It is a volume, so in this case it will be a scale factor, would be a natural candidate for time. But for example, in closed models, this is not single valued, and so various people have raised questions about utility of using this as a notion of time. Can one have a deterministic evolution across a singularity and at the same time agreement with general relativity at low curvatures? For example, in the closed models, the universe starts with a Big Bang, expands out to maximum volume, and then recollapses into big curves. So, as I mentioned before, the problem with perturbative approaches is really to get that they do not resolve the Big Bang or the Big Crunch, because they need a background space-time, and the equations just break down near the background. However, the nice thing about these perturbative approaches is that in between, of course, there's usually not much of a problem, you actually follow the classical evolution in the regime where general relativity is good. With the non-perturbative approaches, which do not have background independence, there might be discrete structures, as in loop quantum gravity. And because of these discrete structures, maybe we are okay at the Big Bang and the Big Crunch, the singularity may be resolved, but what happens when the universe is large? We are not a priori guaranteed that you'll be getting a good semi-classical limit, you'll get a good good agreement with general relativity about, for example, about the recollapse. And in fact, a couple of years ago, Green and Andrew pointed out some potential problems with approaches such as loop quantum gravity, where, in fact, the recollapse, they thought it might be difficult to reproduce the recollapse up here. So there is this tension. Roughly speaking, the first one sort of ask us to talk about the ultraviolet problems. Can you cure the ultraviolet difficulties? And the second one says, can you get the familiar classical physics also at large distances? So background dependent perturbative approaches have difficulty with the first, while the background independent one have difficulty with the second. So these are the questions that we have had, the questions that very general ones which don't really depend on any specific approach, and then the questions which depend on using either the path integral method or the canonical quantization starting from general relativity or supergravity. And it turns out that these issues have been resolved in loop quantum cosmology in the various models. Many questions.
One question, you say emergent time, you mean emergent time is the same way that it emerges classically, or do you mean emergent time in some sort of quantum mechanics like in
Yeah, I mean deparameterization. Yeah, go question.
When you compare to classical GR, like in your first question, in your previous question, is there some operational way to on the previous like?
Yes.
Is there some operational way to do it? You just, I guess, compare expectation values.
Yeah,
like
we'll see. That's, we're going to see it all in detail. So these are the general scenario. I mean, so we're going to see this in great detail. That's the whole point of the model. That's why I chose a model in which one can actually see what are the observables, what is one doing, how does one know one is actually mimicking GR, and when is it good and when is it bad. Okay, so the emerging scenario, I'm sorry I didn't realize that this bottom half, I guess the projector could have been lifted a little bit, but the bottom half may not be visible from the first row. But the emerging scenario is that the physical sector of the theory can be constructed in detail, and the continuum is actually a good approximation till the curvature attains Planck scale, and we will even be able to put some numbers there. And in the simplest models, there are vast classical regions, that is a pre-Big Bang branch and a post-Big Bang branch, and they are bridged deterministically by quantum geometry. And there is no new principle, no new boundary condition that is needed. Okay, now the idea about looking at cosmology is an old one, because in classical theory we start with, I mean, most of the work in classical cosmology is based on homogeneous isotropic models and perturbations thereon. So the idea in the late 60s and then developed in the 70s by DeWitt and Misner and others was that, well, let's just look at homogeneous isotropic cases where the only degrees of freedom are the scale factor and the matter field. And if we do that, then only, since there are only finite number of degrees of freedom, the field theoretical difficulties are bypassed, and the analysis is reduced to standard quantum mechanics. So you take the states to be states of scale factor and the scalar field. The scale factor, for example, operates by multiplication, and so on. And therefore, now you can go to general relativity and write down the only non-trivial constraint that is left in the theory because of homogeneity and isotropy. And that constraint, then you just use this prescription of operators and write down an operator equation. And this is like the Schrodinger-like equation, if you like, and this is called the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And for the k equal to 1, the closed model, it looks like a times d by dA whole squared, operating on a wave function, times a constant, times a to the fourth times psi. This is the potential that is coming in because of the closed nature of the cosmology, is equal to the matter Hamiltonian operating on the wave function with another constant. And if we use this equation, then one can ask the following question. Okay. The question is really, you start the solution of this equation, which is sharply peaked around a classical solution at some late time. And then you evolve this solution backward and see if, in fact, what happens to this solution near the singularity. Is somehow there's a bounce, or in fact, the wave function just spread out, and there's a singularity in some sense. But what happens is that the wave function actually accurately tracks the classical solution and goes straight into the singularity. And it is in this sense that the singularity is not resolved. And we're going to see this, in a little bit more detail when I look at the explicit model.
But, I mean, we're just going to solve that equation. I mean, it looks like there's no obvious pathology in
A. Right. So the statement is that the solutions, nonetheless, I mean, if you look at compute the curvature, the expectation value of the curvature, that just blows up. because you just go to the wave function just goes to A equal to zero. You do not get an evolution across A equal to zero or anything, right? I mean, the same sense in which classical equation is perfectly well defined.
I'm just thinking that you complete the curvature idea of a particular classical metric, but this is a wave function of
just right, but this is a curvature operator, right? Or you can take the density operator. These operators are well defined. You can make derive observables out of it, take expectation values, and see what is happening to them. And see if in fact and fluctuations and everything. And the wave function remains very, very classic, very, very sharply peaked. Fluctuations are small, but the mean values are getting infinite.
How much of that depends on the precise nature of the matter Hamiltonian? I would imagine that it's suitable quantum matter Hamiltonian.
Yeah, so this is all for matter Hamiltonians, which are classically, they are all just satisfying some energy condition. These are all the...
That builds into the...
So classically, I mean, of course, quantum mechanically, this energy condition is violated, but classically. So I'm not talking about, say, phantom matter or something like that.
So really the key point here is, as you say, without additional assumptions, right?
Yeah.
The key point is in some sense that this equation actually is not well defined at A equals zero. Usually it requires, at the very least, the addition of a boundary condition or some other bit of information. There are always, typically are ways to make this system give you an answer, but by making additional assumptions about it.
Right. It's a little like the square root of 8 times that in Steve's talk. I mean, you have to sort of make sense of that and how to continue it. But I mean, really, expectation of that, I will see in a minute. So I'll show you the plots and you'll see what exactly is happening. Now, what happens is that in loop quantum cosmology, the situation is very different because there is an underlying quantum Riemannian geometry. Now, at least my first reaction was that how can this be? Right? I mean, because from the 70s, this has been known since the 70s, and I had concluded that there is no way to make sense of loop quantum cosmology because this is quantum mechanics. And von Neumann's theorem tells us that there is only one way of doing quantum mechanics. The only freedom we would have would be some factor ordering changes up here. And somehow, just by playing around, you can see that the changes in factor ordering are just not enough in order to resolve this problem. So how is this possible? Well, what happens is the following, that if in fact you follow the procedure that comes down from loop quantum gravity in these cosmological models, then one of the assumptions of von Neumann's theorem is violated. And therefore the uniqueness result is not bypassed. And you get inequivalent representations of the canonical commutation relations, even for mini superspaces. And of course, the idea here is that you could use a standard representation, but we should use the one which sort of is, which results by following the same procedure as in the full theory. And when you do that, you have new quantum mechanics. And then these new quantum mechanics have novel features which become manifest precisely in the Planck regime. And that is the reason why there is a departure from, a conceptual departure from the Wheeler-DeWitt theory. So how does this happen? What is the main point here? I mean, what is the main difference between Wheeler-DeWitt theory and this and loop quantum cosmology? So here is just one transparency summary of what the key ideas of loop quantum gravity that make this difference already in the mini superspace approximation. Well, as many of you already know, the configuration variable here is a spin connection on a spatial manifold, and which parallel transports chiral spinners. And the conjugate momenta then are kind of non-abelian electric fields, which now have a dual interpretation of being orthonormal triads. The gauge group here is SU2, which is the double cover of SO3, the group of rotations of the in the tangent space at any point. Or more precisely, SU2 will be for spin diodes. And now there is a surprising uniqueness result, which just appeared in Communications this year, I think, by these people here. Two of the authors are here, so you can talk to them in great detail. And the surprising result is that starting from these connections, you can build holonomies, and starting from these electric fields, you can build some fluxes of these electric fields across two-dimensional surfaces. And these are kind of the natural variables to construct your quantum algebra. It's like the Q's and the P's of quantum mechanics. So if you construct this algebra, and now if you ask, does this algebra admit diffeomorphism in varying states? And the answer is that yes, and there is exactly one diffeomorphic invariant state, and therefore, using the state, like mathematically think of it as a vacuum, you can construct a unique background independent representation of the basic algebra. Now this result is new, but the representation really was known since the early 90s, more than 10 years now, and it has high mathematical precision, and it provides the quantum geometry which replaces the Riemannian geometry that is used in classical gravity theories. So this is sort of just, the details of this is not important, but you should just know where one is coming from. There is something in the full theory, and where there is a uniqueness, there is a representation, and in cosmology, we are going to mimic this theory.
Diffeomorphic means invariant under all the constraints, Hamiltonian and...
No, everything. Just the diffeomorphic under the three-dimensional group of diffeomorphisms.
And only one state in the Hilbert space,
One state. So it's not in the Hilbert space. So the idea here is that you have an algebra, and the state is considered to be a positive linear function on this algebra, like the expectation value function, the algebraic approach to begin with. And then you look for a state which is diffeomorphism invariant, and there is only one. Then there is a given the state, you construct the Hilbert space. So at the end of the day, so there is the beginning of the day and the end of the day. At the end of the day, there is a Hilbert space, and there is a unique state which is diffeomorphism invariant. But that's not very surprising. I mean, in the sense that if you take Poincaré invariant theories, then at the end of the day, there is a unique state in the vacuum which is Poincaré invariant, and the Poincaré group acts as, you know, covariant by unitary.
But in classical geometry, there are many, many states which are invariant in the spatial diffeomorphisms.
No.
Let me ask what I think is the same question here from language. I should know this detail, but I'm confused about it. Normally, one says that in, for example, canonical GR, all solutions to the constraints will be diffeomorphism invariant. And so it appears that you're going to tell us that there's only one physical state in the system. This is not your message, and so I'm confused about, there's a technicality here which is confusing us.
I think, why don't we come back, because I just want to, can we come back to this? And because it's not really going to be important for what is important is that there is a representation, and I agree that I should explain this, and I'll explain this. Okay. So the important thing is really that there is no operator which is, no operator corresponding to the connection itself, right? In this representation, you start with the connections, but there is no operator corresponding to the connection itself. The mathematical analogy would be that holonomy is well defined. So in quantum mechanics, it's like having e to the I lambda x being well defined, but there being no operator corresponding to x itself. See, what von Neumann's theorem asks is that this u lambda should be well defined, but x also be well defined. That is to say, it should be weakly continuous in lambda. And that is not, assumption is not met here, and in that sense, the von Neumann's theorem is actually bypassed in quantum cosmology, in loop quantum gravity. So, let me summarize. So we have all these conceptual issues, and then there is a loop quantum gravity, there is a kinematical framework which is well understood, and now what we are doing is, we are going to copy that kinematical framework in the context of symmetry reduced models, which are loop quantum cosmology. So let me consider homogeneous isotropic model, and I'm going to ultimately be focusing on k equal to 1, but at the moment k can be anything. And the canonically conjugate variables are the connection and the triad. Now because I got isotropy and homogeneity, therefore I can build here background co-triads and background triads, just because of group invariance. These are things that Beverly told us about. And the connection, all the information of the connection is contained in a single number C, and that in the triad is contained in a single number P, which are functions of time, are constants in space. So this C is like a dot, like the time derivative scale factor, and the P up here is like this. It is like the scale factor itself. The absolute value of P is equal to A squared. So just as we had the scale factor and we had A dot, right? We got scale factor and we got this. And we had the canonically conjugate momentum. So now we have got the connection, which is like A dot, and the scale factor, which is like p. P actually takes both positive and negative values, but going from one sign of p to the other sign of p, all it does is to change the orientation. Right-handed triads become left-handed, and that is a large gauge transformation that leaves the physics invariant. And now we've got a canonically conjugate pairs, namely we've got pairs which are C and P. These are the canonical conjugate variables for gravity. So it's exactly like A and the canonically conjugate momentum of A. And then there, of course, is phi and P phi for matter. Now, the statement is that we look for loop quantum cosmology. And the key strategy is that in Wiener-DeWitt theory, one would say, okay, your configuration variable is C. So your Hilbert space should be just the square integral functions of C. And C should just operate by multiplication, and P should operate by differentiation. But we don't want to do this naively. We want to follow the full theory. And the full theory, we know that there is no operator corresponding to the connection. There is operator only corresponding to the holonomy. So this gives us this new quantum mechanics. And now what are the states of this new quantum mechanics? If I go to the P representation, the states can be expanded out in terms of eigenbras, eigenkets of the P operator. But the new element up here is that in fact you only have a countable, this I runs only on a countable number of points. It's a sum, not an integral. So the norm of psi is given by absolute value I, psi I whole square, and these PIs are actually normalizable. Here you've got a Kronecker delta and not a Dirac delta. And that is why this representation is completely different from the standard representation. What about operators? Well, there's a perfectly well-defined operator P. This multiplies by multiplication. This is a familiar one. And what about the operator corresponding to the holonomy? Well, holonomy is just the exponential of a connection, some parameter e to the I mu c, where mu is some parameter. And all that does is to shift the value of this P by this parameter. Okay, it's not good. So it's exactly like an ordinary quantum mechanics, but this action is not continuous in P in this Hilbert space, as opposed to the standard Hilbert space, and therefore there is no operator corresponding to C. Please.
You keep saying holonomy, but what curve are you taking?
Good. Thank you. So in the thank you very much. So we just consider in the spatially homogeneous cases, if it is k equal to 0 model, for example, any model, we've got these triads, EAI, look at the integral curves of these triads, and you just consider the holonomy along the integral curves. So you don't have to have a loop, and you can make a loop out of the integral curves also, but you don't have to have a loop because of spatial homogeneity, even the holonomies along edges are a gauge invariant. So the reason why this Hilbert space is very different, and therefore I cannot just take d by d mu of this, and I think you can just convince yourself that it's true, because all I have here is a countable sum up here. I cannot take d by d mu of this, and that is the reason why there is no connection operator C. So this representation is equivalent to the Schrodinger representation, and therefore new quantum mechanics is possible, and this kinematic structure mimics the kinematic structure of the full loop quantum gravity. Now I got a Hamiltonian constraint, and there's a matter part which you can quantize in a standard way, and then there's a gravitational part. The gravitational part has some dependence on the electric fields of the triads and some dependence on the field strength F up here. Okay, we got these two things. And now the statement is that this object can be taken over to quantum theory using a certain trick that Thomas Stemann taught us some time ago. And the field strength, however, is the thing that I want to concentrate on. Because I do not have a connection operator, to begin with, I do not have a field strength operator either. So what we'll do is to express field strength in terms of holonomy. We have to express field strength in terms of the holonomies. Now, we always do that in gauge theory. We take field, if you want to know the field strength at this point, I can take a loop. And I can express field strength in terms of this holonomy, right? Holonomy minus 1 divided by the area of this loop, taking the limit as area goes to 0. And the holonomies are well-defined, but since field strength itself is not well-defined operator, that means if I take the limit to 0, I'm not going to get something that is well-defined. So the idea here And this is the key point that the question Jim was asking. The idea up here is really that you shrink this loop. The idea is that this is happening because we are not paying any due respect to quantum nature of geometry. The full theory is telling us that, in fact, the eigenvalues of area are quantized. So the smallest loop we should consider is not, we should not shrink the loop beyond the minimum eigenvalue of the area operator. You just stop there. And you get some operator, which is going to be a non-local operator, and you are going to identify the field strength operator to be that non-local operator. Non-locality is just the Planck scale, because the area of this loop is roughly Planck length squared. I mean, that's a small number of the order of one, but it's Planck length squared. So this operator is non-local at the Planck scale. Of course, if you look at a semi-classical state, you can just take the shrink the loop, take the expectation value, and then shrink the loop, and then there'll be no problem. So the local operators are arising in a semi-classical way, but at the fundamental level, the operator is non-local at the Planck scale. David first, and then.
So am I supposed to think of this new quantum mechanics as being just ordinary quantum mechanics, but on a discrete momentum space?
It's not a discrete momentum space, because these p's are the statement is that this mu here is can take on continuous values, right? I mean, this mu is not a discrete parameter to begin with. Mm-hmm. Mu can take on continuous values. So it's not that, right? I mean, this, because then it will be just all like ordinary quantum mechanics in a box or something. That's not what this is. Yeah, you have a question.
Area operator is, I mean, the smallest area when you take expectation value in your unique state.
No, the area operator is an operator on a Hilbert space, and you look at the its eigenvalues.
And your unique state is supposed to correspond to what?
It is the unique state in this whole case is diffeomorphism invariant. So its expectation value, the metric roughly speaking, will be zero in that unique state. It is like 2 plus 1 gravity, right? I mean, it's not something that looks like...
That would correspond to zero for connection.
It will be zero every time. It will be very... Yeah, it's a diffeomorphism invariant state. So there is no diffeomorphism invariant metric, right? I mean, so it's not easy to think about. Yeah. So these are not discrete. So P takes values on a real line. But the waves, the states, have support only on a countable number of points. Now, this is the reason, I mean, this is the difference between the standard quantum mechanics and this quantum mechanics. And this quantum mechanics emerges, I didn't derive it for you because it'll take too long, too long in the sense 20 minutes. But I'm just telling you what the final answer is. And the last transparency, I made the remark that that we got some kind of a new quantum mechanics coming. It's like having the while operator well defined, but X not being well defined.
I understand that. I didn't understand this discreteness.
Okay.
So this is a non-separable Hilbert space.
It's a non-separable Hilbert space.
So the individual points have
unit norm. Right. Right. Exactly. Individual points have unit norm. I mean, state is equal to one at an individual point is well defined as unit norm. And that is why this operator is perfectly well defined. It's unitary, but it's not weakly continuous. It's not continuous here because the real line has discrete topology. The P line has discrete topology.
Is that a consequence of some property of the operator P, or that's an assumption of the P? That you have discrete states.
This is the if you follow the procedure from loop quantum gravity in the cosmological context. Then this is the representation you are led to. So if you like, I mean, following that procedure is an assumption, but then this is a fact. Now finally, what happens to quantum dynamics here? Well, what happens is the following. It turns out, for technical reasons, just the form of the Hamiltonian constraint is simple. If you don't use a variable p, which went like a squared, but instead you use the variable v, which is like that, goes like a cube. And if you do that, then the Wheeler-DeWitt equation becomes a difference operator equation. So we had a while ago, Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Wheeler-DeWitt equation up here. On the right-hand side was a matter-Hamiltonian operating on the wave function. On the left-hand side were a differential operator. Now, in this new quantum mechanics, what is happening is that on the left-hand side, well, the right-hand side is similar. It's exactly the matter-Hamiltonian operating on the wave function. And on the left-hand side, instead of having a differential operator, we are getting a difference operator. Here I get a function C plus of V operating on psi, evaluated at V plus 4 and phi. Then C0 of V operating on psi, V, phi. And C minus of V operating on psi, V minus 4. So it's really like a second order difference operator that comes about. And that comes about, this operator comes about, really following the procedure I wrote down in the last transparency that I was explaining about using these field strength in terms of this holonomy. So the step of the size is governed by the minimum area that I just mentioned on this transparency. Okay.
Modified Hamiltonian.
Well, this is the modified. I mean, there's no Hamiltonian constraint that we had, right? I mean, we have classical Hamiltonian constraint, and we don't need to quantize it. In this representation, there is no local F operator. So the viewpoint is, just 1 second, the viewpoint is that the fundamental F operator is actually non-local, and that's what it is.
Now, you don't see this simple model, but is this why Lorentz invariance is broken, because you've modified the Hamiltonian constraint and not the Hamiltonian constraint?
Well, okay, so the thing is that I'm not sure Lorentz invariance is broken in this. In what sense it is broken is much more subtle than. So maybe we should, again, there's another good topic for discussion. There is another question? Oh. So now, we have got the Hamiltonian constraint, but we are now, I mean, after all this jazz, I'm just at the level of having the analog of the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And we still have the same problems as we had in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Namely, we ought to isolate time to give meaning to the evolution. We ought to look at the solution to this constraint. From that, we can want to construct physical states, introduce physical inner product and suitable observables, construct states which represent actually universe at late times, and then evolve it back towards the Big Bang, and ask the question, is a classical singularity resolved? If so, in what sense? And what is on the other side of the singularity? So all these questions now have to be asked, but first, we have to understand the physics of this particular equation.
What's the ultimate origin for the
discreteness
of this protein?
It really is that the area is the minimum eigenvalue of area. If you take the minimum eigenvalue of area, call it delta times Planck length square. Delta is a number, dimensionless number up here. If you take that delta, go to zero, then this differential equation, under some regularity conditions, goes over to just the difference. The difference equation goes over to the differential equation. It is a non-zero, the fact that there is a smallest area eigenvalue. That is the origin. And that is what is governing the size of the step. So the last part is really this detailed model. And so this is a concrete example. I would like to consider this k equal to 1 Friedman-Robertson-Walker model with a massless scalar field. Well, this is instructive because in this model, every classical solution is singular. Every solution, so I'm plotting the solution as a plot of volume of the universe and the scale factor. And every classical solution begins with a Big Bang, grows, expands out, grows to maximum size, undergoes a classical Reeve collapse, and then contracts into a big crunch. And in this case, scale factor is not a good clock, because scale factor is, at any given value of scale factor, you've got two points in the classical trajectory. But you can see here clearly that phi is a monotonic function up here, and therefore the scalar field is a perfectly good clock in the classical theory, and therefore the idea is that to use that, okay, the scalar field is a clock, and this model is simple, but it also provides a foundation for much more classical, much more complicated models. Now, so I have the Wheeler-DeWitt equation which I have written down up here, and I'm just rewriting it here. I'm writing it as, this was the matter-Hamiltonian. The matter-Hamiltonian now is free scalar field, therefore it is just minus h bar squared times g2 by d phi squared. So this is not a Hamiltonian. And then on the left hand side, we have the difference operator. And the difference operator now is just c plus of v operating on psi at v plus 4, c 0 of v function times psi of v, c minus of v, psi of v minus 4. And now, this is the form of the function. This is the form of the Hamiltonian constraint operator. Second order differential, d2 by d phi squared is equal to some, it turns out to be a positive definite or a negative definite because of the minus sign, elliptic operator, negative definite, self-adjoint, difference operator operating on this very function. So this equation suggests that it is really has the same form as a Klein-Gordon equation in a static space-time, where phi would play the role of time and theta would play the role of the special Laplacian with an additional potential. And so the idea that phi can play a role of the time in the classical theory goes over to the quantum theory. And so we can talk about how does a wave function evolve with respect to this internal clock, phi. So we can ask for correlations. When phi is so-and-so, the wave function is peaked at this value of v. Then when phi changes to this another value, what does the wave function evolve to? So we have got the relational dynamics. And now we can just try to interpret what is happening in terms of this internal clock, the scalar field up here. So the physical states are going to be solutions to this equation, which actually are invariant and v goes to minus v, because v goes to minus v just changes the orientation, doesn't change the geometry. And the observables, what are the observables? Well, since it's a zero rest mass scalar field, there is no potential. So p phi is a good observable. P phi is a Dirac observable. So if I take p phi, so if psi is a solution, p phi times psi is also a solution, because p phi will just come out of here. P phi is just d by d phi. And similarly, p phi will just come out of here, because all this operator just involves v. So p phi is a good operator. And the other good operator is what is called the relational observables, namely, what is the volume when phi is equal to phi naught? So give me a solution of this equation, fix a value of phi naught equal to 3, and evaluate what the value of, you know, and look at the operator, which is just multiplication by v at that particular instant of time. So what you do is, given a solution of this equation, and phi naught equal to 3, freeze the solution at time 3, multiplied by v, and evolve it again, and then you will obtain a new state, and that state is the result of our operation, is the result of operating v hat on the original state. And now, the idea is that we want to use numerical methods to solve the quantum constraints. And I really want to say that a big progress occurred, in my view, I mean, at least my understanding on this whole subject, is because of this numerics. And I think, I think it was David who said that there were theories are these two black boxes. My black boxes are these two talented postdocs, particularly Tomas Pawlowski and Param Singh, who had done the numerical work. And my job was just to ask them awkward questions and make sure that we run many, many tests to ensure that the numerics are perfectly okay.
Fine.
Yeah.
Did you work out the relation between phi and proper time?
Yes, it is in the paper. I don't have it in. It's proper time is probably.
Are they non-singularly related at what would be the classical say a equals zero?
I think so. Can we just check?
Classical solutions fly diverges at the singularity, right?
No, not in this case. Not in the closed models. Here is a closed model. So it depends on if the model is closed or not. Okay. So actually, classical solutions cycle. I mean, phi is up here, and then you will have another phi. So this interval is finite.
Oh, I see.
There's always a problem whether to look at k equal to 0 model or k equal to 1 model, but for k equal to 1 model, this is finite. Okay, so now what we want to do is the following. Okay, let's go back to the Biot-David equation. I mean, I think now my results are just plots, so hopefully I can explain them easily. So you can just go to this Biot-David equation up here. And for the Biot-David equation also, it is true for the exactly the same reasons as I mentioned now. For the massless scalar field, you can use again phi as an internal clock. You can do this evolution. And we got these Dirac observables. We got the Dirac observables, namely P phi and the volume. And so we can ask, how do these Dirac observables evolve with respect to the internal clock? So the idea is, here's a classical solution. Take this point on the classical solution and construct a state at phi equal to this value, whatever the value here is, that let me take phi equal to minus 0.5. So I take this point in the classical solution, where the universe is large, and construct a state which is sharply peaked at this point. Okay? And let the equation take over and evolve and see what happens. So we do it first using the Wheeler-Deville equation. I start up here and I let it evolve. And what I do is, I just calculate the expectation value of phi at a given value, sorry, expectation value of volume V at a given value of phi. Right? How does the volume change as I change phi? And I look at dispersion. And I want to know, do the dispersion remain small? And what happens to the mean value? So the dispersions remain small, and what happens to the mean value is that you just go to the classical singularity, in this case between minus 2 and plus 2. So Wheeler-Deville equation solutions very faithfully follow the classical trajectory right into the singularity. I mean, to me, it was a bit surprised that they can follow this trajectory so well.
Are you really just taking a phi and peeking around the given value of V, or do you need some sort of coherent state?
Yeah, coherent state. So it's a coherent state. So because we have to make sure that it's peaked also at a given value of P phi, because P phi is, and at the given value of V. And so there's a coherent state that is peaked. There are three different kind of natural candidates for coherent state, so the runs were done with different choices, and the results don't change. There are details which are different, like what happens exactly to the dispersion and so on near the bounds, but the main features don't change at all in this case. Then we can ask what happens with loop quantum cosmology. So we do the same thing, right? We take, what was it, minus 2.5 something, that's some point here. Minus 2.5. In fact, we can give ourselves exactly the same state in the Wheeler-Deville and this theory. And we use the loop quantum cosmology equation and evolve it. So the state evolves backward evolution towards the Big Bang quite nicely following the classical trajectory until something happens. Here the classical trajectory is just going into the singularity. But here, instead of going to singularity, there's a bounce. And I'll explain this a little bit better. There's a bounce, and then the universe expands out again. Or as you want it forward, the universe expands out, and at the place where the classical theory would have told us that there should be recollapse, there is a recollapse. The universe recollapses and goes back up here. And finally, classical trajectory would have just gone into the Big Crunch, but again, there's a bounce. So basically, you got this cyclic kind of universe which goes between bounces in classically. You can look at the wave function. This is somewhat, this data intensive kind of file, so it doesn't come out too well. Basically, the same. This is the absolute value of the wave function, and you give yourself wave function somewhere here, say, for example, sharply peaked here, like a covariant state, as Gary was saying, and then we evolve it backward. And then instead of going into the singularity, there's a bounce, it comes back, it goes back, it goes back. Okay, so what are the results? So let me just summarize these results. That we assume that the quantum state is semi-classical at a late time. And we evolve backwards, and also we evolve forward. Then, the state remains semi-classical till very early and very late times. So what is very early, very late time? Till the only curvature, non-trivial curvature here is a scalar curvature, because in these models the Wild-Theta curvature is zero. Till the curvature becomes of 13 pi upon Planck length squared, or the density here becomes 0.82 rho. And these values are kind of robust in the sense that I will explain in a minute. Okay? Then the space-time can be taken. So this means that the space-time can be taken to be classical during a really huge epoch. Namely, in particular, during the inflationary epoch. It's only when the scalar curvature, when the curvature exceeds this, or the density becomes bigger than 0.82 than rho Planck, that is where the duty is actually failing. Something new is happening right there. So in the deep Planck regime, when this happens, the semi-classically fails. But what do these numbers mean? Ted would ask me. It means that at these values, the quantum corrections are of the same order as the classical terms. The one, order one, the two of them. So in the deep Planck regime, semi-classically fails, but the quantum evolution is well defined through the Planck regime, as we just saw. A wave function keeps evolving without any problem, and it remains deterministic. You do not need a new principle. So the Big Bang is replaced by quantum bounds. And just 1 second. Or maybe I should. Yeah.
Yes, but think of if you were to calculate the expectation value of R in this state, would it blow up at once?
No, it doesn't blow up. It remains gone. So we actually calculated in detail the expectation value of rho, for example. And completely separately. And it follows the. The Big Bang is replaced by quantum bounds. So what is happening is that there is some kind of a new repulsive force that is coming into the picture, and this is because of the quantum geometry. This is because of this non-locality of this field strength operator that we talked about. Now, unlike in other approaches, bounces, this is another question that was asked about matter. This is not a question about matter. Unlike other approaches to bounces, like the pre-Big Bang and the ekpyrotic universe and so on, there is an unambiguous evolution across this bridge, this quantum bridge, and it is provided by quantum Einstein equations. Now, there is a very interesting relation, potential relation with the Hartle-Hawking wave function that we are actually pursuing, which is the following, that if I look at these trajectories, then there's a bounce point. Of course, at the bounce point, what happens is that a dot vanishes, right? I mean, because the volume dot vanishes up here. That means here, the extension curvature is zero. So if you did not want to think about, you know, the other branch at all, you just want to do, you're only interested in one branch, you could, probably, you could just bridge this, right, because it's k equal to zero, this is dying to be bridged to Euclidean space, the solution up here, and you'll get a Hawking, Hartle-Hawking wave function, no boundary proposal, that is perfectly applicable up here. But, I mean, in this whole scenario, the full quantum theory, the idea is, the viewpoint is, has more information, and things can come from previous branches, which would be lost if we did this. But, nonetheless, I think that would be a very good effective description of what is going on. That, so, although we did not need, a boundary condition, there's actually probably a nice relation with the Hartle-Hawking no boundary proposal. There is no unphysical matter. This is some question that was asked before, in the sense that the matter field that we're talking about here do not violate energy conditions or anything like that. What is happening is that Einstein's equations themselves fail and are replaced by something else. That is how singularity theorem is avoided. Right? And this is an important thing. That Einstein's equations don't apply, and that is why there is no singularity. Singularity theorem is not applicable. And the notion of semi-classicality is precise, namely we use these coherent states. It's not some WKB method or something, because these WKB methods, fluctuations are not under control, and of course we don't know whether to trust these methods near the singularity. Here, fluctuations are under full control. And the last thing is that the notion of this semi-classicality is really weak. Because now we can start asking the questions, right? And we can, and this, I'm just giving you a flavor of a few questions. We asked lots of questions. I'm giving you a flavor of a few of those. We can ask the question, well, I started with a state which is semi-classical up here, and then it remained very semi-classical. I even got a nice recollapse at the point that the classical theory said. How large should the universe be to qualify as semi-classical? Right? I mean, and what we find is that so long as the radius of the universe at the maximum, at the recollapse, the maximum radius of the universe is about 10 Planck length. Is 23 Planck length, sorry. Classical relativity is fine, right? I mean, classical relativity predictions are okay up to, you know, 2%. just 1 second, for the recollapse value up here. But of course, it's not fine when there is actually bounds up here. And in this small universe, which only expands out about 23 Planck length squared, the bounds occur just below 10 Planck length. So something, I mean, the effect is very dramatic. It happens, it overwhelms the classical theory and switches itself back very, very quickly in a very small region.
I'm just wondering about at the recollapse points, how to interpret the curve. So it looks like something is happening there. Is it, are those sort of dispersion bars?
These are the, yeah, dispersion bars.
So is it true that the dispersion is getting bigger at the recollapse
point? So these details are really depend on the choice of the initial data. So I think with dispersion, we'll try to sit and see what happens with each choice of the initial data. I don't want to make a blanket statement, basically.
But the sense of the question is just, is that it's a physically significant effect that you're finding kind of drifting away from classicality?
Good. Next time, we're going to talk about this. Yeah, sorry.
But when you say the radius is 23 Planck length, how is this
going to
turn into? I mean, what's the operation?
V. Right? I got a V operator. Mm-hmm. And I'm calculating the expectation value of V, and this is a three sphere, so I just take V divided by 2 pi squared and take 1/3 power, and that is the radius.
You're just saying that by the way, you try to quantify how Einstein decision breaks down.
Yeah.
So, is there a sort of expansion in your Planck? Can you randomly effective?
I'll say, everybody is just too good. I'm answering all these questions just in the next transparency. Okay. Effective in my question. So now there is the effective Friedmann equation. So let's forget about the red term to begin with. Just look at this term up here, right? This is like the classical Friedmann equation. A dot upon A whole squared is equal to 8 pi g by 3 times rho upon minus rho over rho 1. Well, rho 1 is just equal to this thing. It's just equal to 3 upon 8 pi g times A squared. A squared is the just the scale factor squared. So that is a particular, that is the Friedmann equation up here. That Friedmann equation is modified. Rho 1 now is not just given by this, but there are corrections. The corrections of the are of the order of L to the 4th upon A to the 4th up here. And this explicit formula just will not look good on the transparency. But however, there's another term that comes up. This is the interesting part. Because classical Friedmann equation, the blue equation, the recollapse occurs. When does the classical recollapse occur? Well, classical recollapse occurs up here when A dot is equal to 0, because also a turning point, and precisely your V dot is equal to 0, which is precisely the turning point. So in our case, in the Friedmann case, in the classical equation, when rho, the matter density, equals this particular function of rho, at that time, there is recollapse. That's what happens. So what we see here is that, that is when there is a recollapse. And then there is actually a corrective term, and that corrective term is rho 2 of V minus rho upon rho critical. Rho 2, the leading order term in rho 2 is just equal to 1 plus corrections of the order of L squared upon A minimum, a squared, L squared upon A squared, that correction. 1 plus this thing, these are corrections. Minus rho upon rho critical, and rho critical is Planck density. So when the density of matter is way below the Planck density, this term is negligible, and I just add 1 here, and I get the classical equation. But now, the interesting thing is that while this equation, the original equation, had only one root, which was that large universe, now I acquire a new root, and this root is when the universe is very small, where there is actually a recollapse. So I already told you about this thing, that namely, classical recollapse happens when rho of V is equal to rho 1 of V, and I already told you that if you take, for example, so how large the universe is depends on the value of how much matter there is, so it depends on how much P phi is, how much energy there is, basically. The classical C equal to G equal to 1 units, P phi is the dimension of H bar, so we took it about 5,000 H bar, so to make it a little bit classical. Then A max is about 23 Planck length, and the agreement of the classical Friedmann formula is then, classical Friedmann formula is really is about 1 part in 10 to the 5. And for macroscopic universes, the loop quantum gravity prediction of the recollapse is really indistinguishable from, this should really be, the recollapse, the really indistinguishable from the classical Friedman formula, because the correction is of the order of LP upon A to the fourth. So this dispersion that we're talking about, right? So for example, did I write it down? So the effective equation is not fit to the numerical data. It is a fit to the numerical data, but that's not how it was obtained. So what we have been doing, there's a student, Josh Willis, who was my student in his thesis, and then this work has been further done by both Martin and his student and by me, is really by it's developing an effective equation for a framework for the in the Hamiltonian context. Usually effective actions and so on are all in the Lagrangian thing, but here there's the effective equation framework, which actually comes very naturally if you start with a geometrical formulation of quantum mechanics. So I don't want to go much more than that. We start with a geometrical formulation of quantum mechanics, and there is a very nice way of understanding the effective equations. And so they were obtained using that geometrical formulation of quantum mechanics, and so it was derived analytically. And you know what the errors are. The errors are of the order of I think it is V cube upon they're all of the order of volume, Planck length to the ninth power divided by volume cube. So you know the accuracy of this equation up here. So basically, recollapse is really for something like we have it in the paper. I just don't remember it now. But if you take a universe which actually expands out to Planck's to a size of a megaparsec, then the recollapse, the quantum prediction about where the recollapse occurs, and classical prediction is like they agree to 1 part in 10 to the 50. It's really huge. It's a really good agreement. Now, what about bounces? These are the new things. So the bounce occurs when the density becomes equal to rho 2, right? When this vanishes, that is when a dot can vanish again, and that is where the bounce occurs up here. And the maximum value of the density, which is the bounce, so to say, is equal to this universal value that I wrote down, 1 plus LP squared upon A minimum whole squared. So even for this universe, which is only, which recollapses about 10 Planck length, that this is only a percent effect. That's why I said that it only is up to 2%. I mean, if you look at the details numerically, it's about 2%. And for large universe, of course, this is completely negligible, and there is a kind of a more or less universal value that is attained when the recollapse occurs. And again, this is a Dirac observable. Density is a Dirac observable, and you can calculate it. And we can just separately numerically calculate this and follow its evolution, and this is all plotted in the table. Now, for a universe which attains a maximum radius about 1 megaparsec. A minimum, when does the bounce occur? So A minimum is about 10 to the 16 centimeter cube, which is 115 times the Planck volume. 10 to the 115 times the Planck volume. It's actually absolutely huge.
That's where the bounce occurs?
That's where the bounce occurs for this universe.
Which is still Planck density.
Sorry?
Which is still Planck density, right? This is still your 0.82 rho Planck.
Yeah.
Where the density is in matter?
That is where the density in matter becomes Planck. Right?
So
not very surprising. Not very surprising. No, but nonetheless, in the beginning, if you don't think about it, it looks like, Planck's physics should be important when the scale factor for a spherical universe and the universe of the Planck set. No, quantum effect should be important when the curvature is Planck scale. And that can occur even when the universe is of a macroscopic size, because it all depends on what the total matter content is in the universe, and how much total matter.
When you increase A mass, what happens to A n?
They increase. So basically, A max goes like.
See, if I can just calculate the radius of the universe back in time using standard cosmology. You evolve back to the Planck scale, and that gives you A min, becomes whatever you assume for index.
So So, but basically, it's a, in this model, A max scales like P phi to the 3/2, and A min scales like P phi. So P phi is kind of the matter content, how much matter there is. And now, the last thing is that this is kind of a little bit, it's not the same effect, but there's a little bit of a shadow of this idea that matter doesn't matter. That's not in the same sense as Beverly and David were saying. The sense is of just the following, that if we look at the basic equation, if we look at this basic equation that one is trying to solve, this difference equation occurred because we are looking at the field strength in terms of the holonomies. But we also have the matter Hamiltonian up here. And this matter Hamiltonian, as we all know, will go like P phi squared upon A cube. There's always this volume element in the matter Hamiltonian at that.
In what sense is that difference equation unique?
It's unique in the sense that, again, we should perhaps have more detailed discussions about how to derive this equation. It's unique in the sense that there is a certain way of handling this particular operator, which came from the full theory. One is using the same thing in this case, and one is looking at this FAF operator, the field strength operator, in terms of the holonomy. So there is an assumption that holonomy is basically a non-local operator. Field strength is basically a non-local operator given by looking at the holonomy around a loop of a Planck length or Planck area divided by Planck area. That is the assumption. But after that, the difference equation is just a difference equation. There's no assumption in the difference equation.
Aren't there an infinite number of different difference equations that would match with the same physical input figure?
No. There are infinitely many difference equations which will match with which will be discretizations of the Wheeler-Deffit equation. That's true. But here we're following a particular procedure, right? Namely, I got an operator. I got a quantum constraint operator. And I'm telling you, it has two elements, one coming from triads, one coming from the holonomy. And we're using this method that I just told you, which is descending from full theory. And this holonomy idea is also descending from full theory or from gauge theories that the field strength should be given by holonomy. The new input is just that we should stop shrinking the loop when it is Planck area.
Yeah, but it's at that step I think I'm worried that there are extra assumptions coming in, and you might do things in a slightly different way.
Not in a homogeneous isotropic context, I think, but we should talk about it. Not in a homogeneous isotropic context.
Another famous singularity is the classical electron singularity. And that would be easy to solve due to Lorentz invariance, because you just smear the electron out into a rigid ball. Many, many solutions. But that's not the route nature chooses, because if you did that, you would break Lorentz invariance in serious ways. It's really, really hard to solve singularity problems and to retain Lorentz invariance where we have it. So when I see you modifying the Hamiltonian constraint, you know, you have a theory which is guilty until proven innocent. That is, you really have to show you've retained Lorentz invariance where we know it survives. But it's not surprising you can solve singularity problems if you give up Lorentz invariance. No.
But I think in the context of the electron, right, the electron is moving in Minkowski space, we have Lorentz invariance and we should do it. We should keep it. Right. Here I'm talking about cosmology, right?
You're talking about a theory you're embedding this in a more complete theory. The justification for this is embedded in this more complete theory of gravity, and that's supposed to be a theory of nature which is supposed to reproduce low energy physics, which is Lorentz invariant to high precision. So I'm saying, you this has to be checked.
But I don't agree that the electron and all. Your main point is completely well taken. In fact, I'm going to discuss it in a minute, which is that a gap here is really this is an even bigger gap than what you said. A, really deriving this systematically. At the moment, one is following the prescription for the full theory. But one really first reduces the degrees of freedom and apply the prescription of full theory to the reduced. We really don't even have kind of the thing that maybe you are assuming we have, which is that start with a full loop quantum gravity and don't, you know, full one. And then in the quantum theory, look for symmetric solutions or something like that. We haven't even done that, so we're not there. I mean, and then after one has done that, I agree that one also has to go and look to see if, in fact, this theory produces valid low energy physics. I mean, I agree that otherwise, I mean, but there's always progress, right? I mean, just like the problem of the hydrogen atom. I mean, let's talk about it later. Let me conclude. I think that's better. Should I just?
I guess we have a question now. I mean, how close are you to finishing?
I'm almost very close to finishing,
close,
but maybe.
I just have one question while we're in the sort of discussion mode. I mean, it's very nice to see these weight packets bouncing and avoiding the singularity, but in quantum mechanics, it's probably the question of whether the singularity should be a probabilistic one. Even though the senders follow these, is the probability strictly zero if you would ever hit A equals zero in these models?
Yeah. So if you look at the inner product and calculate the probability using the physical inner product, the probability is strictly zero that you hit the...
Sorry, strictly zero? You mean that if you calculate this because it's a rule for the volume at a given phi, it's never zero?
It's never zero. Right? It's strictly zero. Then, right? Oh, you said never zero.
It's strictly zero.
Yeah.
Strictly for all states?
Strictly zero, never zero.
The probability is strictly zero if the volume is ever zero. Yeah. For all states?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we'll discuss this.
That's something I'd like to understand better.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have minded if you said, no, the probability is not strictly zero.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't have also minded it. I wouldn't have minded it so long as, you know, the probability is kind of extremely small or something. I wouldn't have minded it, but I'm just telling you what the answer is.
As far as the difference is well-defined, it wouldn't bother me.
So summary. So in loop quantum gravity, the interplay between geometry and physics is elevated to the quantum level, and physics does not end at singularities. Now in k equal to 1 and k equal to 0 FRW models, with or without cosmological constant, there is a complete control in the physical sector of the theory. And the loop quantum cosmology evolution is deterministic across the classical Big Bang and also the Big Crunch for all quantum states. The states, which are semi-classical at late times, detailed numerical and effective descriptions and comparisons between the two have been done. Like, and the effective description works extremely well. And rho critical is about 0.8 by 2 Planck density for all these models. So just, I mean, quickly again, just to say what happens in k equal to 0 model is that the universe begins with a big bang and expands out all the way, or it can begin being very large and contracts into a big crunch. If you start out of today's universe, so if you start at the quantum states up here somewhere, and then you expand and you evolve it back, right, you evolve back up there, then the statement is that it follows the classical trajectory very well until the density becomes 0.82 times Planck density, and then there's a bounce, and it joins on to this other trajectory. If you have a cosmological constant, which is positive, then in fact the whole evolution is actually occurring in a compact domain as far as phi is concerned, but the picture is very similar. Normally start with a big bang and go out to infinity, or you can start with a large universe which collapses to big crunch, and the two are also the picture is qualitatively similar. If it is actually negative cosmological constant, then the universe actually recollapses because the matter density can become minus the cosmological density somewhere. And the statement is that the quantum evolution actually reproduces what is happening at the large at the recollapse point. Then again, universes which are as small as, you know, for which A max is about 25, 23 Planck length, they already are semi-classical, and there is a repulsive force of quantum geometry that arises and it dies very quickly. And there was a challenge to the background independent theories, namely, we have to have a detailed recovery of classical general relativity at low curvatures, and this is met in the cosmological models. And now, just what about more general models? I just want to be very quick up here. So more general models have been worked out at level 2, which is to say the physical Hilbert space has been worked out with anisotropies, and at level 1, in which the quantum constraint is well behaved, never breaks down, has been worked out for a whole bunch of things, which are anisotropic models, black hole interiors, and even some mini superspaces by Martin. And there is a large body of work on effective equations and their applications, for example, to this chaos in Bianchi 9 that Martin told us about a while ago. And a sample of the current work, some of these points have already been discussed. Namely, this is just a mini superspace. What happens if you have infinitely many degrees of freedom? There's a whole bunch of people now working on Gaudi models, where you've got infinitely many different degrees of freedom. So this is really a mini superspace. And inclusion of inhomogeneities. This work has just been begun by Martin Boyer-Wall. And then some implications to string-inspired models, like the cyclic models of this quantum geometry. They have been worked out. And then relation between the loop quantum cosmology and loop quantum gravity, the point that I just mentioned to Joe. This is a really big problem, and this is something that has been people have been started to look at very seriously. I already told you about these effective equations in answer to Gary's questions, that there is a Hamiltonian analog of that, and there is work going on up here. And finally, I mean, the statement is that there is this singularity which is resolved in these very special cases, one after another, after another. And this reminds us very much about what happened with singularity theorems. And first one looked at, in classical relativity, situations with high degree of symmetry, and then singularity arose. And then there were very general theorems. The question is here, are there some very general singularity resolution theorems? Can we, for example, take states, like look at constant mean curvature foliation and quantize the theory in that particular time gauge? You will have, again, I'm sure you've got a notion of time, and then see what is happening. Does the Planck scale non-locality of this FAB and quantum geometry kind of repulsion really solve? Does this have an effect even in a completely general context? So here, of course, I mean, these are things that people are just beginning to think about, but there's a hope that maybe one can understand the nature of general singularity. Thank you.
Could you say just a little something about current thinking on the relationship between loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology? I mean, I just want to understand, over the past couple of years, I've heard some positive comments, and there were some maybe negative results from Thomas at one point, and I've lost track of the current discussion. Is it sort of wide open now, or is the, I know there's some things left to do, but is the answer wide open, or is it sort of narrowing?
It's narrowing, but it's a very difficult problem, so even if it's narrowing, it's not that we are going to have a solution next month or something. But the issues really that Thomas and so on had raised really had to do with this inverse volume effect. At that time, numerical simulations had not been done and so on, and how important these inverse volume effects are. And what we find is that these inverse volume effects are not really important at all. Something else is important altogether. So to some extent, that this is also something that Hermann Nicola has always sort of emphasized, these inverse volume effects are not, it's kind of a, seems like a, but as far as this discussion is concerned, it's a little bit of a red herring. So, maybe what we should have just one or two questions and then we stop. And I'm here for tea, so we can just continue informally.
Yeah, okay, maybe one more question, and that's very
cool. In your models, there was a symmetry between sort of Big Bang and Big Crunch, but in theory, we don't generically expect that. So is the lesson that somehow it should be more symmetric, or is it just because it's simplified?
It's simplified. So the statement is that really, that in these simplified models, the isotropy and homogeneity is implying that the wild curvature is always zero. So the big, in these simplified models, there is not really asymmetry between the Big Bang and the Big Crunch. But in the more general models, you would expect the Big Bang to have kind of very special. That also has some ideas of understanding of in what sense Big Bang is special, but we can talk about it privately. Namely, that the wild curvature there will be zero, whereas with the Big Crunch, the wild curvature actually will be infinite. And so in general, I think the two things will be quite different from each other.
Okay. Thank you.